River God by Wilbur Smith. The river lay heavily upon the desert, bright as a spill of molten metal from a furnace. The sky smoked with heat haze, and the sun beat down upon it all with the strokes of a coppersmith's hammer. In the mirage, the gaunt hills flanking the Nile seemed to tremble to the blows. Our boat sped close in beside the papyrus beds, near enough for the creaking of the water buckets of the Shadouf on their long counterbalanced arms to carry from fields across the water. The sound harmonized with the singing of the girl in the bows. Lostris was 14 years of age. The Nile had begun its latest flood on the very day that her red woman's moon had flowered for the first time, a coincidence that the priests of Hapi had viewed as highly propitious. Lostris, the woman's name that they had then chosen to replace her discarded baby name, meant Daughter of the Waters. I remember her so vividly on that day. She would grow more beautiful as the years passed, become more poised and regal, but never again would that glow of virgin womanhood radiate from her so overpoweringly. Every man aboard, even the warriors at the rowing benches, were aware of it. Neither I nor any one of them could keep our gaze off her. She filled me with a sense of my own inadequacy and a deep and poignant longing, for although I am a eunuch, I was gelded only after I had known the joy of a woman's body. "Taita," she called to me, "sing with me." And when I obeyed, she smiled with pleasure. My voice was one of the many reasons that, whenever she was able, she kept me near her. My tenor complemented her lovely soprano to perfection. We sang one of the old peasant love songs that I had taught her, and which was still one of her favourites. My heart flutters up like a wounded quail when I see my beloved's face, and my cheeks bloom like the dawn sky to the sunshine of his smile. From the stern, another voice joined with ours. It was a man's voice, deep and powerful, but it lacked the clarity and purity of my own. If my voice was that of a dawn-greeting thrush, then his was the voice of a young lion. Lostris turned her head, and now her smile shimmered like the sunbeams on the surface of the Nile. Although the man upon whom she played that smile was my friend, perhaps my only true friend, still I felt the bitter gall of envy burn the back of my throat. Yet I forced myself to smile at Tanus, as she did, with love. Tanus' father, Pianki, Lord Harab, had been one of the grandees of the Egyptian nobility, but his mother had been the daughter of a freed Tehenu slave. Like so many of her people, she had been fair-headed and blue-eyed. She had died of the swamp fever while Tanus was still a child, so my memory of her was imperfect. However, the old women said that seldom before had such beauty as hers been seen in either of the two kingdoms. On the other hand, I had known and admired Tanus' father, before he lost all his vast fortune and the great estates that had once almost rivaled those of Pharaoh himself. He had been of dark complexion, with Egyptian eyes the colour of polished obsidian. A man with more physical strength than beauty, but with a generous and noble heart, some might say too generous and too trusting, for he had died destitute, with his heart broken by those he had thought his friends, alone in the darkness, cut off from the sunshine of Pharaoh's favour. Thus it seemed that Tanus had inherited the best from both his parents, except only worldly wealth. In nature and in power he was as his father, in beauty as his mother. So why should I resent my mistress loving him? I loved him also, and, poor neutered thing that I am, I knew that I could never have her for myself, not even if the gods had raised my status above that of a slave. Yet such is the perversity of human nature that I hungered for what I could never have, and dreamed of the impossible. Lostris sat on her cushion on the prow with her slave girls sprawled at her feet, two little black girls from Kush, lithe as panthers, entirely naked except for the golden collars around their necks. Lostris herself wore only a skirt of bleached linen, crisp and white as an egret's wing. The skin of her upper body, caressed by the sun, was the colour of oiled cedar wood from the mountains beyond Byblos. Her breasts were the size and shape of ripe figs, just ready for plucking, and tipped with rose garnets. She had set aside her formal wig, and wore her natural hair in a sidelock that fell in a thick dark rope over one breast. The slant of her eyes was enhanced by the silver green of powdered malachite cunningly touched to the upper lids. The colour of her eyes was green also, but the darker, clearer green of the Nile, when its waters have shrunk and deposited their burden of precious silts. Between her breasts, suspended on a gold chain, she wore a figurine of Hapi, the goddess of the Nile, fashioned in gold and precious lapis lazuli. Of course it was a superb piece, for I had made it with my own hands for her. Suddenly Tanis lifted his right hand with the fist clenched. As a single man, the rowers checked their stroke and held the blades of their paddles aloft, glinting in the sunlight and dripping water. Then Tanis thrust the steering oar hard over, and the men on the port bank stabbed their backstroke deeply, creating a series of tiny whirlpools in the surface of the green water. The starboard side pulled strongly ahead. The boat spun so sharply that the deck canted over at an alarming angle. Then both banks pulled together, and she shot forward. The sharp prow, with the blue eyes of Horus emblazed upon it, brushed aside the dense stands of papyrus, and she lanced her way out of the flow of the river and into the still waters of the lagoon beyond. Lostris broke off the song and shaded her eyes to gaze ahead. "There they are," she cried, and pointed with a graceful little hand. The other boats of Tanis' squadron were cast like a net across the southern reaches of the lagoon, blocking the main entrance to the great river, cutting off any escape in that direction. Naturally, Tanis had chosen for himself the northern station, for he knew that this was where the sport would be most furious. I wished it was not so. Not that I am a coward, but I have always the safety of my mistress to consider. She had inveigled herself aboard the Breath of Horus only after much intrigue in which, as always, she had deeply involved me. When her father learned, as he surely would, of her presence in the thick of the hunt, it would go badly enough for me. But if he learned also that I was responsible for allowing her to be in the company of Tanis for a full day, not even my privileged position would protect me from his wrath. His instructions to me regarding this young man were unequivocal. However, I seemed to be the only soul aboard the Breath of Horus who was perturbed. The others were simmering with excitement. Tanis checked the rowers with a peremptory hand signal, and the boat glided to a halt and lay rocking gently upon the green waters that were so still that when I glanced overboard and saw my own reflection look back at me, I was struck, as always, by how well my beauty had carried over the years. To me it seemed that my face was more lovely than the cerulean blue lotus blooms that framed it. I had little time to admire it, however, for the crew were all abustle. One of Tanis' staff officers ran up his personal standard to the masthead. It was the image of a blue crocodile with its great coxcomb tail held erect and its jaws open. Only an officer of the rank of best of 10,000 was entitled to his own standard. Tanis had achieved such rank, together with the command of the blue crocodile division of Pharaoh's own elite guard, before his 20th birthday. Now the standard at the masthead was the signal for the hunt to begin. On the horizon of the lagoon, the rest of the squadron were tiny with distance, but their paddles began to beat rhythmically, rising and falling like the wings of wild geese in flight, glistening in the sunlight. From their sterns, the multiple wavelets of their wakes were drawn out across the placid waters and lay for a long while on the surface, as though moulded from solid clay. Tanis lowered the gong over the stern. It was a long bronze tube. He allowed the end of it to sink below the surface. When struck with a hammer of the same metal, the shrill reverberating tones would be transmitted through the water, filling our quarry with consternation. Unhappily for my equanimity, I knew that this could readily turn to a murderous rage. Tanis laughed at me. Even in his own excitation, he had sensed my qualms. For a rude soldier, he had unusual perception. "Come up here in the stern tower, Taita," he ordered. "You can beat the gong for us. It will take your mind off the safety of your own beautiful hide for a while." I was hurt by his levity, but relieved by the invitation, for the stern tower is high above the water. I moved to do his bidding without undignified haste, and as I passed him, I paused to exhort him sternly, "Have a care for the safety of my mistress, do you hear me, boy? Do not encourage her to recklessness, for she is every bit as wild as you are." I could speak thus to an illustrious commander of 10,000, for he was once my pupil, and I had wielded the cane on more than one occasion across those martial buttocks. He grinned at me now, as he had in those days, as cocky and impudent as ever. "Leave that lady in my hands, I implore you, old friend. There's nothing I would relish more, believe me." I did not admonish him for such a disrespectful tone, for I was in some small haste to take my place in the tower. From there I watched him take up his bow. Already that bow was famous throughout the army, indeed throughout the length of the great river, from the cataracts to the sea. I had designed it for him when he had grown dissatisfied with the puny weapons that, up until that time, were all that were available to him. I had suggested that we should try to fashion a bow with some new material other than those feeble woods that grow in our narrow riverine valley. Perhaps with exotic timbers such as the heartwood of the olive from the land of the Hittites, or of the ebony from Kush, or even with stranger materials such as the horn of the rhinoceros or the ivory tusk of the elephant. No sooner had we made the attempt than we came upon a myriad of problems, the first of which was the brittleness of these exotic materials. In their natural state, none of them would bend without cracking, and only the largest, and therefore the most expensive, elephant tusk would allow us to carve a complete bow stock from it. I solved both these problems by splitting the ivory of a smaller tusk into slivers and gluing these together in sufficient girth and bulk to form a full bow. Unfortunately, it was too rigid for any man to draw. However, from there it was an easy and natural step to laminate together all four of our chosen materials, olive wood, ebony, horn, and ivory. Of course, there were many months of experimentation with combinations of these materials and with various types of glue to hold them together. We never did succeed in making a glue strong enough. In the end, I solved this last problem by binding the entire bow stock with electrum wire to prevent it from flying apart. I had two big men assist Thanos in twisting the wire onto it with all their combined strength, while the glue was still hot. When it cooled, it set to an almost perfect combination of strength and pliability. Then I cut strands from the gut of a great black-maned lion that Thanos hunted and killed with his bronze-bladed war spear out in the desert. These I tanned and twisted together to form a bowstring. The result was this gleaming arc of such extraordinary power that only one man out of all the hundreds who had made the attempt could draw it to full stretch. The regulation style of archery, as taught by the army instructors, was to face the target and draw the nocked arrow to the sternum of the chest. Hold that aim for a deliberate pause, then loose on command. However, not even Thanos had the strength to draw his bow and hold his aim steadily. He was forced to develop a completely new style. Standing sideways to the target, addressing it over his left shoulder, he would throw up the bow with his left arm outstretched, and with a convulsive heave, draw back the arrow until the feathered flights touched his lips, and the muscles of his arms and chest stood proud with the effort. In that same instance of full extension, seemingly without aiming, he would loose. At first, his arrows flew at random, as wild bees leave the hive. But he practiced day after day and month after month. The fingers of his right hand became raw and bleeding from the chafing of the bowstring, but they healed and toughened. The inside of his left forearm was bruised and excoriated, where the bowstring slashed past it on the release of the arrow. But I fashioned a leather guard to protect it. And Thanos stood at the butts and practiced and practiced.